Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and this is another two-hour segment of Zero Point Radio. We explore the study of mystical and spiritual psychology, discussions of physics and ancient metaphysics, discussions of modern times and the dilemma we're in as a human race. We range really across the universe in our discussions of everything from local politics to the most ancient of mystical teachings. My background is as a clinical and forensic psychologist for 12 years, working in the correctional system. And previous to that, I was a university professor for 12 years in a psychology department. But my lifelong interest has been in the study of human consciousness, which led me from Western science and psychology into the study of the mystical traditions. For now, I've explored in these areas for probably about 30 years. My main areas of study have been in the Gurdjieff Uspensky Fourth Way teaching, the Theosophical teaching of H.P. Blavatsky and the Secret Doctrine, yogic and Vedic teachings, and Kabbalah. I'm also very interested in the newest ideas in physics and quantum theory and new ideas about cosmology and how the newest ideas in science, how they're related to the ancient ideas of the mystics. I usually begin with a 10, 15, 20-minute talk, so I'm going to share a little bit about a chapter I'm revising in my work at the moment. It's from my book, The Heart Doctrine, which I would say is the most important of my writings. The basic argument in The Heart Doctrine is that the origin of consciousness in the human being is actually related to the physics and science of the heart, and that a human being is ensouled through the mechanisms and the physics of the heart. And that the human heart, although in one way it seems to simply be a mass of soft muscle tissue, it has its own energetic or electromagnetic system. And the electromagnetic volume of the heart is 5,000 times greater than the electromagnetic volume of the mind in the head. So there is a sense in which the heart is truly the center of a human being and not the mind in the head. This idea has never seriously been considered within Western psychology study of consciousness, and nor in most of the New Age writings. People almost unanimously assume that the mind is centered in the head and that higher states of consciousness have to do with awakening different faculties again in the mind in the head. In The Heart Doctrine, I explained that in all of the esoteric traditions, the true nature of the self or of I is connected to the heart. In the Bhagavad Gita, it is the jiva atma, the individual self, which is centered within the heart. In Blavatsky, it's the monadic essence, which is related to the higher dimensions of the heart. In the Sufis, they talk of the divine spark. And the Kabbalist might speak of sparks of holiness. Shirley MacLaine, in her writing called In Going Within, used the word, mentioned the idea that the basic New Age belief is that we all have a God spark within us. Okay, so the idea is that there is a God spark, and that somehow is embodied or functions through the human heart in bringing consciousness and life into the living body and into the person during their material life. So that the idea is that life and consciousness originate from the heart and they spread out through the body connected to the blood. So mystics connect the flow of blood and the oxygenation of the body is connected to consciousness and awareness in the body. This compares with the modern scientific view that the brain and the head produces consciousness and that our awareness of self is centered mainly in the head. So I compare the heart doctrine to the head doctrine. And I argue that we need to have a metaphysical understanding of the nature of the human heart. And in particular, in the chapter I'm working on at the moment, it's called Zero Point Origins. And I draw from the secret doctrine of Blavatsky, where in the beginning she describes the symbol of a circle with a point in its center. And this point for Blavatsky represents the first point of differentiation of a cosmos. And the circle represents space. So it's like you have a point source within the sphere of space. And that represents a person's zero point center, that we similarly have this higher dimensional zero point center, and that there's actually a physics to this. There's a higher dimensional physics to us as human beings. And this contrasts with modern science, which has led us to believe that we're only biological organisms that live and die with the body, but have no spiritual nature, no soul, and no divine element. Whereas I would say a human being is not only physical with a physical body, but then has a soul nature. They are ensouled. And then they have a spiritual nature, threefold nature, and then there's the fourth level, which is the divine source emanation. So that's like the God spark within the human being. So I argue there's an actual science to the understanding the human heart and the higher dimensions of the human heart. In a way, the heart is a computer. In a way, it is a black hole computer. In a way, there is an element established in the higher dimensional physics of the heart. To understand the heart, we have to understand the idea, the nature of space, because the human heart exists within space. So to understand consciousness in the heart, we have to understand the mysteries of space. And in the secret doctrine, the main mysteries of space have to do with what's called the ether. And what is the nature of the ether? And Blavatsky spelt the ether A-E-T-H-E-R, which is the more ancient Greek spelling, I understand. So the idea of there being an ether. And for Blavatsky, there is a seven-skinned ether. That the ether of space has seven levels to it. It's what that means in a way is it's quantized, that there are different levels of vibrational activities within the ether. And these are quantized, seven quantized levels produced out of one. So whereas we think of a human being as simply a unitary physical body, really we might have a series of bodies connected and related to these seven levels of the cosmos, that there could be seven levels to ourselves. The idea that human beings have a zero-point center, there's many meanings to this, and I struggle myself to understand it more and more deeply over time and to experience what that means. In a way, I would say there is a form of emptiness or nothingness at the heart of a human being. That in some sense, a human being is a form of no thingness. That in our essential nature, we are a form of no thingness. And it's because of the presence of that no thingness aspect that we can then be aware of all the things. So the consciousness is like the no thingness and space. And then because of the consciousness and the nothingness of space, then we can be aware of all these experiences in our lives and our minds and thoughts and actions. So I try to explain some of this new idea of the science of the heart and new ideas about the higher dimensional nature of human existence. The last couple of weeks, I, with the co-host, have been exploring the Gurdjieff Uspensky Fourth Way teaching. And we'll pick up on that again today. And today, we'll open the phone lines earlier in the show and invite people to participate more today and really have open discussions. And we'll give those numbers out in a few minutes. So if you think you might call, you might get a pencil and paper, jot down the numbers. I think we're in a very serious time in terms of the socio-political events of current weeks and months. And I think, you know, there's this impending gloom and threat of U.S. invasion and attack of Iran and bombing of Iran, and I really pray with people out there that somehow these madmen are restrained from engaging in another process of reciprocal destruction or warfare and destroying the lives of another million people. I mean, this is quite horrendous that possibility exists there, justified by the most flimsiest of excuses and double talk that one can imagine as to why this would be justified. It's horrible to see here we, meaning Western world, become these imperialist aggressors throughout the world, and we just pray that this war doesn't go ahead, but in a way I have a sense of imminent doom almost in regards to the inability of people to restrain these masters of war who are carrying on such terrible imperialist and sadistic and horrendous crimes against humanity being perpetrated in it. All in the name of spreading democracy, which is such a complete sham. It's just unspeakable how widely people have been deceived by our own governments and media about the events unfolding on the world stage. It's amazing what alert following current events on the internet and being a little more informed and then turning on the mainstream corporate media, and it's just such a sham. It's just so shallow and so obviously deceptive. The more you realize what's happening in the world, the more the evident falsity of the media becomes apparent to you. We've been intentionally deceived and misled and confused and deluded through the media, through the brainwashing of the media so much. We certainly live in an Orwellian world with a ministry of double talk and a Department of Defense which is going on an offense. Terrible things being done around the world. And at the same time, all the corruption and pathology of the elites and the history of the elites is becoming more and more widely known. People around the world are beginning to wake up to the fact that, wow, 9/11 was an inside job. Like, what does this mean about the state of humankind? And our governments have hidden this from us, and the police are complicit in covering it up, and the intelligence services and the media. There's this great split in the psyche of people. in the splitting of the American psyche between the world that people carry on and some people, the sheep people, can't carry on, just hypnotized by the TV and the world of material gain and success. Well, meanwhile, there are more and more people homeless and not fed and disease and poverty and conflict, all these things growing with not only in other nations around the world, but in the USA and Canada, Mexico, throughout the world. All these horrendous hardships are being brought upon humankind intentionally by the elites and with their global schemes and plots and plans and so on. It's really quite horrendous. The more we learn about history, we just see history in a completely different light. It's like these people have written the last history book, so we don't really know what happened in the past. We don't really know what happened in Second World War, and now the patterns of history are being revealed more and more. How many of these things have been schemed in ways unspeakable. So we all have to try to stay upright in heart in facing what hopefully will not become a period of total madness in the history of humankind. But I think because of these, on the one hand, the awakening of people to the crimes being committed by the government and within the world, people awakening to that, and on the other hand, the elites kind of wanting to move forward with their global agenda and take it one step further. You know, we live in a pretty critical kind of time period. We just hope to be part of the solution, spreading information, helping to wake people up to learning about what's happening in the world. Okay, so that was a few notes then on the heart doctrine and zero point idea, and then a little discussion of the world situation. I think I'll move along now and introduce the co-host is James Moffat from Toronto, Ontario, Canada. Jim, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me okay? I got a lot of buzz on my line here.
Oh, you do? Oh, no, I'm fine. I can hear you well.
I think it's my telephone, actually.
Oh.
I had a little problem lately. Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah.
Sort of.
Yeah, have you been watching the news lately? Have you been kind of watching this build-up towards a war in Iran?
Oh, I don't see that happening.
You don't see that happening?
No. I can't see that. If McCain gets elected, perhaps, but I didn't. Bush is out of time. I mean, on the other hand, there was a thing a couple of weeks ago when Cheney was in Iraq and somebody asked him a question. They said, well, given that two-thirds of the American public disapprove of the United States being in Iraq, what do you have to say to that? And he said, so?
Yeah.
they don't care. There was a New York Times poll the other day that 81% of the American people think the country's headed in the wrong direction, which is the highest since they've been doing the poll. It's the highest level of disapproval in the history of the country. 81%. I mean, and it cuts across pretty much every socioeconomic group, every kind of political affiliation that has, it's just it's almost universal that something like, I think 4 to 6% said that the country was better off than it was 4 years ago or something to that effect. But, it's kind of like these guys are going to do what they're going to do, and, it's very hard to sort of turn this around on any kind of meaningful level. It's very peculiar how it, no matter who gets elected, it's like the old joke, the government still gets in, and I would say, the people who are in the military-industrial congressional complex, that was actually the original phrase that Eisenhower wanted to use, but when he gave that speech about the military-industrial complex, he wanted to include congressional, but he thought it was too controversial, so he sort of backed off it. But, it's like the money is spent, and the money will continue to be spent, and these guys are going to find ways to spend it. So, That's where the real power is. It's these huge corporations and special interest groups that are bent on being in a state of, you know, constant war or preparation for war, because that's where the money goes.
Yeah.
And you know, if you want to build a weapon, even if it doesn't work, the best way to build it is to make sure that every congressional district gets a piece of the work. So you put money into each congressional district. It's very hard to resist, you know, even plans for weapons that don't work to get built. You know, there was a book called The Power Game written in the mid-80s by a guy named Hedrick Smith, who was, I believe, the Washington Post. And it's a really good explanation of how these things work, you know, and the inside mechanics of how the military-industrial complex works in relation to Congress. And that's what they do, is that they just put money into every congressional district, and even things that even the military themselves didn't want ended up getting built, according to this book, because no congressman would vote against it, because, you know, they were getting money in their district and it was creating jobs, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, it's like the other side of it all is what Eisenhower said in that documentary, Why We Fight. His grandson was quoted as saying that what Eisenhower pointed out is that, you know, every time you build a tank or you build a supersonic fighter, this is X number of hospital beds that you're taking away. This is X number of jobs in the economy that could be devoted to manufacturing something useful rather than something that destroys things. You know, I mean, people always say, well, the military-industrial complex is good for the economy. Well, it's good for that portion of the economy that's involved in the military-industrial complex, but it's not really good for the economy in general.
It produces nothing of wealth.
It
destroys things that have material wealth, and
yeah.
It doesn't produce anything of wealth.
Yeah, and it pours all this money into really, like, low returns in terms of jobs, you know. Like, I mean, you'd be much better spent, you know, off spending the money on finding ways of increasing agricultural production naturally instead of, you know, with this agribusiness or building products that people use, or, you know, God forbid, developing products that are more environmentally friendly. I mean, there's a million different ways that the economy could be improved, but the biggest drain on the economy is all this money spent on militarism. You know, it was the 40th anniversary of Martin Luther King's death earlier this week on April 4th, and the last speech that he gave, and it's funny, nobody ever quotes this, but the last speech that he gave, he said that the three greatest threats to the American people were militarism, materialism, and racism. And, you know, 40 years later, what's changed?
Wow.
Yeah, a very astute analysis of the state of the country in 1968, and I think a very astute analysis of the country in 2008. You know, I think it's basically the same problems. And I mean, the most important, well, they're all important, very important problems, but I think the most important now, the most obvious one is just the militarism is just, you know, so out of control.
Yeah, it's impoverished the American as a country and brought about, like, the collapse. I mean, the payout to that firm, the investment company, I mean, the huge, huge tax burdens put on the American people to shore up this kind of false system. And now so many people losing their homes, and the threat of the value of your dollar is going down and down, and costs going up, and people on fixed income. And I think people are a lot more threatened and scared than they used to be that these problems are coming home to America in a way that they haven't before. I think people are realizing, seeing the patterns of all, you know, these detention centers being built everywhere and the militarization of the police everywhere. They, you know, more and more kind of SWAT teams, the money's put into guns and military, quasi-military units in different communities. You know, what's all this for? Like, all that's wasted money. You know, it's not just a war industry. It's all these security industries created by these same people, but all of which cost huge amounts of money, but don't produce anything materially of value.
Yeah,
you know, you go anywhere now, and there's a video camera everywhere.
Well, it's to protect.
You know, in the grocery store, everywhere there's a video camera. Like, did they really? Were there not many people stealing tomatoes? You know, it's just insane. You know, everybody at the airport, everybody's got to take their shoes off. Because they had this one hoax of this guy who got on the plane. And
well, it wasn't a hoax. The guy did have a bomb in his shoe, you know.
I thought they allowed him on, and there was a question about that. And
the whole thing is absurd. It's totally out of proportion to threat levels, you know, and risk levels. That's what, you know, people forget is that, you know, it's just completely ridiculous in terms of the expenditures, but it's to create a state of fear. It's just like, as I said before on an earlier program, I was reading this book on an essay on the European witchcraft craze, and if you substitute the word terrorism for witchcraft, it's basically exactly the same thing. It's you create this mass mobilization of fear, and you keep people afraid all the time of this invisible enemy. And you impute all sorts of things, like, you know, I mean, what does anybody really know about Al-Qaeda? From what I understand is that, you know, it's a terrorist organization which is very diffuse, and it's a terrorist organization. That's the whole point. It's not in any country. That's why going to fight in Iraq, even though the association was bogus to start with, didn't make any sense. That's the whole point about terrorist organizations. They're not in any one place, you know. I mean, often they're in the place that they're going to attack. So going to war, you know, to defeat a country and to overthrow their government makes absolutely zero sense. And, you know, as I pointed out also before, you know, Israel has had two intifadas, you know, in Palestine, and it's a space about, you know, 15 feet by 15 feet. So it's like this tiny little, you know, piece of territory, and they, you know, they're not exactly reticent about using force against these people, and they haven't been able to suppress it in Israel, you know. So what's the hope of crushing a terrorist organization by going to war in countries like Afghanistan and Iraq, especially when Iraq had nothing to do with Al-Qaeda, and especially when one of your allies, Pakistan, is home to terrorists, you know? Like, I mean, even the rationale, if you accept that, you know, if you accept the proposition that there's a fight to be fought, doesn't even make sense in those terms, you know? It's completely absurd.
Everything is so kind of psychotically disturbed. I mean, like, how they would justify bombing Iran and bombing their nuclear facilities, probably even using bunker busting bombs with uranium in it to destroy Iran's facilities because Iran might get a bomb while the Americans sit there on their doorstep with 5,000 nuclear bombs. Like, give me a break. Well, and Pakistan's got them, and Israel's got them.
Yeah.
You know, India's got them, China's got them, I mean, the whole thing is just such a complete fraud. It's for oil control, it's to, you know, cut off this upstart that kind of doesn't, you know, do Americans beckoning for them.
It's a terrible thing. That's why, too, like, I mean,
it's
interesting watching the whole situation with Tibet. Is that really, I mean, if you want to get down to, you know, freedom and democracy, there's no more repressive regime in the world where more people are repressed and more people's rights are violated than China. But we're quite happy to trade with them, you know, where it's coming out of our ears because, you know, there's a lot of money in it. So it's like it exposes the complete hypocrisy of it, you know. It's like, oh, yeah, sure, we'll go there. We'll allow them to host the Olympic Games, and we'll all participate. All these Western countries that are so concerned about democracy and freedom in Iraq, you know. Well, I mean, it's completely hypocritical and absurd to, you know, to participate in China. I mean, China's a major repressor of human rights, you know.
Yeah.
But now
it's even evident. Like, I mean, we thought we had democracy in North America. America doesn't have democracy in their own country.
Yeah.
Seriously. Because the media have been so controlled by certain corporate interests and have so led the American public and helped select who people would be. There's not. I think it's been a farce that there's been American democracy. You know, it's been the deception of America. You know, the whole thing is staged. These people are trotted out, and they're just puppets of this kind of underlying elite groups that put on this puppet play for us. I think the whole thing's a fraud. And you see that, like, how when Ron Paul was running for the Republican Party and how the role of the media in trying to marginalize him and downplay him and ignore him and discredit him in whatever way possible, only caving in and giving him some coverage because there was such widespread popular interest. And then I don't believe the primary results. I believe there was voter fraud. And the voter fraud, I mean, the last two elections, you were saying.
Oh, yeah.
The presidential elections, yeah. Voter fraud. Like, why do people think it's democratic, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, we've got, I like the term that John Eisen used from Uncensored magazine in New Zealand. He said we have a psychopathocracy. So it's not a democracy.
Yeah.
It's a classy ruled by psychopaths. So a psychopathocracy.
Yeah.
That's what it is. It's like the psychopaths won the day. They rose, the scum rose to the top, took over the society and then began to poison the people.
Well, it's like that quote from Gurdjieff, you know, like which was almost 100 years ago. He said, you know, when he said that, is the world run by conscious people? You know, who are they? Where are they? Instead, we see the exact opposite. That the world is run by the people who are least conscious, who are least aware of what's going on. You know, and goes on to kind of put the whole thing in the proper perspective. Is that, you know. I like that term. That's very interesting. It's a bunch of no things. Speaking of which, I wanted to come back to something you were talking about earlier when you were talking about zero-point origins, and you were saying that in a sense, at the heart of things, in a human being, that in our hearts, in a way, at the center of our hearts, we're no-thing. There's a no-thingness. But maybe, like, well, my question is, like, when you say that, you mean a nothing which is also a plenum in the sense? Like, I mean, because it's like there's no thing, but it's not an empty no thing. Is that what you mean, or like
a no thing which is empty? That is empty. The plenum is underlying it, but even hidden more. It's like consciousness. It's if we go back to Jean-Paul Sartre's idea about. His idea, there's two kinds of being, he said, being in itself and being for itself.
Right.
And he says, like, objects, material objects, just are what they are. They have material substance in themselves. But consciousness, he says, is you're always conscious of something. There's always some object of consciousness. So, what am I trying to get at? So, it's like, because there's the presence of no-thingness, or it's like, because there's space is something we can't, space has no color, texture, sound, like space is invisible to us, but it's because of there being space that allows us to be aware of all the things which exist within space. So consciousness similarly is like light within space. And it's because of that light existing within space that we can then be conscious of our thoughts and feelings and sensations, different lives, different complex patterns in our life, all the different things we can have awareness of, because the consciousness is always like this nothingness at the heart of being, which is Sartre's term. He talks about the nothingness at the heart of being. So I'm actually saying, yeah, let's take this idea seriously as a physics idea, that there's some kind of false vacuum at the heart of being. And a human being, in a way, we are that emptiness. And it's because our essential I is in that emptiness that then we can be aware of all the things that we're conscious of. But the consciousness always escapes being the things. So something like that.
Well, I'm still kind of a bit confused because if there's light or if there's an I principle or whatever at the center of being, then there is something. I mean, that's what I'm kind of getting at when I was asked about the plenum, is that it's a nothingness in a sense, but in a sense it's not nothing. There has to be something. If it's nothing, it's nothing. You know, like, I mean,
yeah. Yes, it's only nothing on one level of.
Well,
that's what I was trying to get
to. In a sense that it is nothing because on a certain level of interpretation that there's nothing at the center of being. But in another sense, it's like that the I experience and the consciousness manifests out of like this higher dimensional physics and the consciousness is light is sort of like the background against which we experience everything in space.
Yeah.
It provides the light, which in the comparison of the sun and the moon is like the sun is at the heart of being, and its light illuminates the functions of the mind, but rather than the thought that modern science has, which is that the mind produces consciousness, the mystical esoteric teaching suggests that consciousness arises out of a higher dimensions and manifests in a human being and illuminates the psychic functions of the head brain, the mind and the brain.
There's some entity which inhabits the body.
Yeah.
Like the living entity, there's a living entity in the human being connected to the heart. And
yeah.
that living entity connects into the body through the heart and the flow of blood. When a person dies, the life principle withdraws into the heart, but you still exist within your other subtle bodies, as you did even before the death of the physical body.
Yeah. It's interesting, too, when you're talking about the seven skins of the ether. Now, is like in Madame Blavatsky's thought, is the ether the equivalent to the eternal parent space in
yes.
her thought?
Yes.
Yes.
That's the ultimate ether, the higher.
Okay.
There's kind of like, for Blavatsky, there's a higher seven-dimensional ether, A-E-T-H-E-R,
right.
like B major. And then there's said to be a lower Akasha, or the astral ether.
Oh, okay.
So the lower ether is kind of like the ether on the in the realm of our solar system, whereas so there's a lower Akasha or astral light, and then there's a higher dimensional ether, and the lower reflects a higher dimensional ether. In modern science, it's like the idea of the ether is coming back in under the guise of being called the quantum vacuum with
right.
its zero-point fields. Okay, so I would say, yeah, there's a quantum vacuum, meaning a seeming nothingness, which is the plenum, like there's this huge amount of energy and potency in it. And this ether of the quantum vacuum has seven levels to it, that if you could study the structure of the quantum vacuum, hidden within the nothingness are seven latent levels of vibratory creation, hidden even in the seeming nothingness. So that idea of the self, we exist within space, and there's kind of seven levels to those ethers of space.
And would you say that corresponds to Gurdjieff and the Fourth Ray teachings, notion of the ray of creation of seven world orders that descend from the absolute to the moon, to manifest as creation? Do you think that's roughly equivalent to the seven cosmoses that Blavatsky talks about?
Well, that's a really neat way of looking at it. Yeah, I would want to try to draw out those relationships and look at that.
Because I
the
just
structure
listen,
of that.
I
yes,
just
exactly.
listening to you too when you're talking about the lower ether, and it's kind of like it would seem to me that this suggests, like in Gurdjieff's thought, you have the ray of creation and he says that there are seven world orders that that come out of the singularity, the union, the unity, the absolute, whatever you want to call it, where everything is one. And then there's all worlds, which is three. And then each descending level becomes lower frequency of vibration and denser materiality and lower levels of consciousness, and that you have these seven world orders, and that our Earth is in this ray of creation that comes out of that. But he also talks about, see, at the level of the sun, there's an other octave not the sun. I'm trying to think if it's the sun or if it's the solar.
Yeah, the
world.
Lateral octave.
Yeah, exactly.
Which emerges off the main octave.
Yeah, that there's
and,
this other
and the
octave.
The lateral octave
yeah.
has the sun as the top do.
Yeah.
And the moon or the absolute as the bottom do. So there's that side octave with the sun as its top.
That would seem to me it sort of corresponds to what you're talking about you know that it seems to be in keeping roughly with the Theosophical presentation or Blavatsky's model. Very interesting.
Yeah.
And so but that's the thing that you know it's interesting because I was writing about this in terms of cosmology, but I was writing about like what to me one of the most important ideas that I got from the fourth ray teaching, that comes out of esotericism and applies directly to the study of consciousness, is that we have to understand everything in terms of scale. And I would say that in modern psychology and thought on the nature of consciousness, there's no sense of scale. Like it's a very, in Gurdjieff's terms, formatory, very dualistic in the sense that we're awake or we're asleep, and there's no recognition of any higher states of consciousness possible to be realized by human beings, and that the assumption in modern science about the physical universe is that the laws apply everywhere in the universe are uniform, whereas there's within the esoteric tradition there's this idea that while there are higher dimensions and that these higher dimensions there are different laws that are applicable to them. Now in a sense that's recognized in modern science because you know the quantum physics is all about that. It's at the lowest level of measurements, everything breaks down. But in a sense, it's really not recognized within, especially within the study of consciousness. This whole idea of scale is completely lacking, and it sort of goes back to what we were talking about a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about Gurdjieff and how the idea of a master or somebody who is a being of higher consciousness is not really recognized within Western culture. It's like it's foreign to our cultural understanding. Whereas in the East, this idea is accepted that there are certain masters and holy men who have, through their own efforts, have developed higher levels of consciousness and being. And so I'd say that in a sense that combined with other developments in modern science and the rise of materialism and monism has led to this very flatland view of consciousness, that consciousness is produced in the head brain. Nobody can explain where this happens, how this happens. It has no real idea, but everybody assumes that it does happen. But it's in a sense, it's like modern science has boxed itself into this view that consciousness doesn't exist anywhere except within the heads of human beings, which is completely absurd, you know, when you really look at it from an esoteric or a mystical perspective.
Yeah, it's firstly, Western science is faced with this complete enigma and inability to explain what consciousness is. And then there's a huge amount of evidence for all these psychical phenomena, from ESP to out-of-body experiences, to ghosts and possession, to psychical and spiritual healing, evidences for psychokinetic effects. There's all these kinds of evidences suggesting that simply is not true, that there are somehow extended faculties that's within the sphere of human possibility. So you've got this huge body of evidence all suggesting, no, stop, there's something more. You haven't simply proven consciousness is generated by the brain. That hasn't been shown scientifically. And in fact, that's incompatible with so many of these evidences of people whose heart had stopped and were out of their body and could report objective phenomena apart from the physical body, that somehow maintained consciousness even apart from, seemingly, from their whole physical anatomy and makeup. So all these are inexplicable phenomena which are usually ignored. So in a way, what we want to do is all those phenomena give us clues as to what the nature of consciousness must be. So in a way, if we can exist apart from the physical body, then consciousness isn't being produced by the physical body. But instead, the living entity is something that inhabits the body, but can withdraw from the body and exist in subtle bodies and subtle dimensions. So I think, in my view, there's overwhelming evidence for this, and that's why, you know, at a certain point in my life, I became not interested in trying to prove that man has extended faculties, but instead to develop a model of how could these things work? How could this be possible? What would be the metaphysics of consciousness? We see in modern science, in psychology and science, there's no consideration of the physics of consciousness. You know, no one even considers that, whereas I try to explain that, well, consciousness is like light, okay, and there's a physics to light, and consciousness is like space, and understanding what space is. You know, so I'm arguing we need a whole new approach to understanding the physics of consciousness, and whereas the Western science, the head doctrine, they have no physics of consciousness. They don't even think you need a physics of consciousness.
Yeah, it's like the other aspect of the idea that consciousness just isn't an experiential evidence, that it isn't just produced by the head brain, is that, you know, there are literally untold thousands of accounts throughout human history of people having experiences of so-called cosmic consciousness or realizing higher spiritual states, whatever the name you want to give it to it, nirvana or satori or union with the mystical union with the one. But these experiences recur and recur, and what's really striking about them is that the consistency of the descriptions that people offer about what they experience. And on the one hand, there are many different types of higher states, and there are higher states, and then there are higher states. But that these things do occur, and that people can consciously cultivate them. That's the first thing. And then there's the certain elements, like when you spoke about consciousness and light, is that people consistently report experiencing this light and experiencing this supernal light, which is not only like a quasi-sensory experience. That's what Aldous Huxley describes it as in the discussion of light and the mystical experience. But he points out that it's also like people have this feeling that they're in contact with an intelligence and that they come away with it. He said if you look at the experiences of this higher light, people come away with a sense of the essential all-rightness of things. That's his phrase. And also that they repeatedly report losing their fear of death, which, you know, when you really look at that and think about that people have experiences of this light and they lose their fear of death. Now, what is the nature of that light? I mean, what is the nature of what's going on here? To me, it seems absurd that anybody could profess to be interested in the psychology of consciousness and not want to take seriously these accounts. And that's what's so bewildering about what I call the learned moderns, people of modern education and Western culture, have this incredible lack of curiosity about these experiences, which have recurred, as I say, throughout thousands of years of human history. And not only have they recurred spontaneously, but people can cultivate them, and they can explain to you what you have to do to cultivate these experiences. Where I come from, that's called science. It's a science of consciousness and being. On the other hand, you have people like, there's a philosopher, John Searle, who's supposed to be an expert on consciousness. I just want to quote something. I think you know this quote, Chris, but This is, he's in conversation with Susan Blackmore in her book Conversations on Consciousness. He's talking about consciousness, and he says, we know it's all caused by brain processes. All of our conscious states, every damned one of them, is caused by neurological processes in the brain, and the word that counts is cause. Now, a couple of things. First of all,
cause?
Yeah, he's saying that the word that counts there is cause, that they're caused by these neurological
processes in the
brain, and we know this. Well, first of all, a philosopher is supposed to be a little more careful about stipulating things as premises and drawing causal relationships when you don't have any evidence. There's no evidence for that.
There just isn't.
I mean, you know, it's the oldest mistake that every first-year science student is always cautioned about is correlation does not imply causation. Just because certain brain processes might be related to certain functions, in the intellectual or cognitive function, doesn't mean it causes them. It just means that they're associated with them. And in terms of consciousness, there just isn't any evidence for that. It's like Stanislav Grof says that he was one of the few modern theorists who really questions this idea that the brain produces consciousness. He says it's the great metaphysical assumption of Western science that the brain causes consciousness, but it doesn't. There's no evidence for it. It might even be true, but there's really no. Don't tell me that it's based on scientific evidence, because it isn't. Nobody can demonstrate that, and yet people repeat this same assumption as if it's a fact all the time, which is quite incredible. And the other side of it is that there's just so many experiences that suggest that this isn't, you know, the relationship that doesn't hold, that the brain does not cause consciousness. And I suppose the other thing too is, like as you suggested earlier, is that because everybody subscribes to the head doctrine, nobody really sort of looks at the ancient mystical and esoteric teachings, which repeatedly put forth some version of the heart doctrine, what you call the heart doctrine, which is that consciousness arises in the heart, and the heart can be likened to the sun, and the brain can be likened to the moon, and so that the brain works with the light of consciousness, but it doesn't produce the light of consciousness, so it reflects what the sun is providing it, the light that the sun is providing it.
Yeah, it all makes sense. Like,
it doesn't mean
it's true, but it's certainly like it's a way of thinking that's worthy of serious scientific consideration.
Yeah.
I mean, at the very least, you can say that of it. I think the very idea of having the heart doctrine helps to highlight the assumptions made within the head doctrine. Because,
absolutely.
I mean, I can't prove consciousness emerges from the human heart, but I do think it's a way of trying to understand things that could allow us a whole new way of understanding what consciousness is, and it's compatible with our own self-experience in a way that I think the head doctrine isn't.
Yeah.
People don't really experience themselves as only up in their heads. We're all through ourselves, and that's how we experience ourselves. And yeah, the more you begin to understand the heart doctrine and the ideas of consciousness and the blood and stuff like that, the more silly the head doctrine appears. It does to me over time. To imagine that we only have this mind up in the head, you know?
Well, it's just, I mean, in a lot of ways, too, it's just, I mean, it's, when you look at it, even within, if you subscribe to the, you know, sort of a materialist framework, it ignores the fact that we do have all these other very complicated systems in our body which are responsible on some level for our consciousness. Like I say that, you know, Rupert Sheldrake uses this term, and I use it too, is that if you read these people, most of the people who talk about consciousness is if human beings were these disembodied beings, that they're just these head cases that run around, and that the head is just there to direct the body to sort of get around town and feed itself and have sex. But, I mean, you know, there's more to our experiences of ourselves as physical beings, and there's more to our experiences of ourselves emotionally that aren't just our emotional system isn't just in our limbic system. It's related to our limbic system in our brain, but it's not necessarily centered there. And really, I like the idea which places importance on understanding that consciousness is in some essential way related to the blood. It's related to the flow of the blood in the body. And I mean, in the most basic terms, everybody can understand this. If you cut the flow of blood off to your arm, you lose consciousness of part of your arm. If you're sexually excited, you have a flow of blood to your sexual organs. That's where your experience is centered. If you eat a heavy meal, you know, you can feel this heaviness in your stomach because your blood is flowing there to help digestion. And I mean, there are all sorts of examples of this, but in some basic way, that consciousness is related to blood flow, as you pointed out, too.
Yeah.
Modern science studies consciousness by looking at blood flow in the brain, you know? I mean, they it's part of their assumptive framework in a way, but it's funny how they sort of restrict it to the brain and don't kind of see it how it pertains to the entire physical body.
Yeah, it's funny. I was reading an email from the Dalai Lama Center in Vancouver. I get some of their emailings from them. I'm on their mailing list, and it was mailed a commentary on a research study which had tried to look for the kind of neurophysiological components of compassion. And what they did was they studied meditating monks and non-meditating monks in various states trying to experience compassion. And in the whole experimental arrangement, it's all monitoring brain activity. Okay? And they found differences, which I wouldn't deny that could be so. But they don't even begin to consider that, well, maybe we should try to monitor the heart activity and see if there's any alteration in heart activity during the experience of compassion. But no, they think, oh, no, your compassion's up in your head. But, like, who says, you know, have some compassion in your head? You know, like, but,
reach out with your limbic system and...
Like, I would think that if a person's having compassion, that there's probably a certain part of the cortex which is active because the person is mentally, like, considering someone or object of their compassion. So there's a mental component to compassion. It's not just a thing that exists in relation to no cognized object. Like, compassion is of something or someone or some nation or something.
Yeah.
But then is it felt up in the head, in the limbic system, or is it something people can feel in their hearts? I mean, that to me is another aspect that shows the foolishness of the head doctrine. It's like when I ask how many people go home and say to your partner, you know, I love you with all my head. Just, no one does that because people know intuitively that we feel emotions in the heart and elsewhere in the body. But love and compassion are associated with the heart. So there's been no psychology of the heart. See, the psychology of the heart is so closely tied into the issue of the existence of the human soul because the heart and soul are connected.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm saying we find in the mystical traditions of the heart. We are ensouled through the heart.
Yeah.
A human being is. So there's been no psychology of the heart or soul for over 100 years. And in fact, I remember when I was a university professor, I tried to explain to students how all they got in their psychology education mainly was what I called a Mickey Mouse psychology. Is kind of based on the study of, like, monkeys and mice and rats and Skinnerian conditioning and so on, only looking at the lower faculties, like lower aspects of learning and instinctual behavior. So it's Mickey Mouse psychology, and no one ever considered anymore the psychology of the soul. You know, that was dismissed a century ago.
Yeah.
So we've given people Mickey Mouse psychology, and I think that's been intentional. I think that there's certain people who've not wanted the areas of the paranormal to be freely studied and researched in modern times. I think they've wanted to dummy people down, in a sense, and convince people, you know, it's how you persuade people to live their life based on materialism. because all you see is what you get. All you get is what you see, or whatever. What you see is what you get. All there is material reality.
Yeah.
You don't worry about your soul in heaven or your soul, because you have no soul. All you want to do is live to maximize your pleasure and propagate your selfish genes for doctors.
Yeah, but you can make the counter argument too, that, you know, telling people that when they die their souls are going to heaven, and, you know, they're going to sing and, you know, with Jesus all day and have a great time, has been a way of controlling people too. So
I agree with that.
Pie in the sky theory is one of the ways that the slave population was kept down in the United States, is that, you know, they were filled with these visions of the greatness of their afterlife to avoid confronting the horror of their existing life, you know. I mean, and that's a traditional criticism. I mean, that's why, you know, Marx said that religion was the opiate of the masses, and it is. It's always been a form of, it's frequently been a form of social control. And of course, on the other hand, you know, Marxism was a form of social control with people by, you know, which is a secular teaching, which told them that, you know, that they're part of this great historical process for the freedom of the workers, you know, not you workers, but future workers, you know. I mean, there's always something to it, like, that, you know, in terms of controlling people. I just wanted to come back a little bit for just a second and mention something about consciousness existing apart from the body, which I think, as I said, you know, I think that really, if you look throughout the history of humanity, there are thousands and thousands of cases of this occurring in a variety of contexts where people experience their consciousness apart from their body. And I guarantee you, like you said earlier, we're going to take some phone calls and we should give the numbers out. But I just wanted to explain very quickly and ask people, you know, to call in if they feel they'd like to, and if they've had an experience when they've been experienced their consciousness out of their body. But I've been out of my body in a few different situations, but the first time was really interesting to me because I didn't expect it in any way. So I wasn't experiencing something based on expectation. That's the first part. Okay, so I was playing football and I was tackled. My head hit the ground. And what happened was, all of a sudden, I was aware of myself outside of my physical body. I could see my head coming off the ground, and I could see it sort of like, you know, those multiple exposure photographs that they often do of sports, like where a tennis player is hitting the ball, and you see multiple.
So yeah, like a cubist art piece.
Yeah, like Marcel Duchamp, you know, like a nude descending a staircase sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I saw. I saw my head coming off the ground, and then I was back in my body. But I very clearly was outside. I somehow was outside of my body and saw my head coming off the ground. Now, you know, in terms of explaining this, if you applied like Occam's razor, which scientists always invoke to, you know, deny the paranormal events, it seems to me that the explanation that makes the fewest assumptions is to say that somehow I was out of my body. You know, the only thing that's preventing one from concluding that is that we assume that's impossible. But as I say, if you start to add up all the different explanations that suggest that it's not impossible, I would say that the most economical explanation of what happened to me was that somehow I was outside of my body.
Yeah, it is exactly what it appeared to be.
Yeah.
In the very, yes.
Yeah.
I agree. I think the scientists are completely fraudulent the way they apply Occam's razor and say, you know, that there's material explanations for all these phenomena, and they say that as though they can explain them all, and they never really explain any of the phenomena. They just state that and
well, I think in that case, when you read that, I think that, to me, the most convincing body of evidence for that is the near-death experience. When you really look at it with an open mind, and, you know, you have people like, I believe it was Kenneth Ring, quite a prominent psychologist who studied this and went into it sort of with a very skeptical view and went in to try to disprove the reality of the experience, came out believing completely in it that this was a real phenomenon. I think if you look at it and you look at the explanations, oh well, the person's anoxic, you know, they're deprived of oxygen and they're hallucinating, and you really look at the material explanations that are provided, they just don't hold water. They just cannot account for this experience. And when you take the sheer number of these experiences, and often the detail provided by people that would suggest that they were somehow apart from their body, like when they can account for what's happening to them in an operating room when they're supposedly unconscious, then I think the most economical explanation is to say that somehow their consciousness does exist apart from their body and is capable of actually being outside of their body and witnessing their body as from an exterior perspective.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I mean, that's why I became convinced 20 years ago to stop trying to find evidences for psychical phenomena. Instead, what we need to do is develop an alternate model of the structure of reality, which is what I think the zero point teaching provides. It's a new way of trying to conceive of how there might be an actual higher dimensional physics to the human heart. And that the life entity is something that does come out of higher dimensional space and comes into the body. And that when that death is not the end, there's some continuity of identity beyond death. And consciousness can exist from apart from the body. And you can experience expanded states of consciousness which are not dependent upon the brain and the mind and the head. Because a person experiences himself within a volume of space, or like states of samadhi. So there's so many evidences pointing to the fact that there's something more to human beings than simply being biological organisms evolved through Darwinian evolutionary theory. But that's kind of what's been lost. I mean, the elites in the world, they're totally into the occult. And they've studied the occult. I think, you know, there's so much occult symbolism and such among the elitist groups, but they've kept those kinds of teaching from the masses and instead given them the pablum of religion. I mean, I meant to say about, it's interesting in the Bible, you see at end times what a false teaching and false churches are become established, and you just see that today. Like, where are all the Christian churches, you know? Where in the Christian nation is anyone objecting to the mass murdering going on and about to happen? You know, where are all the Christians, you know? All these people who believe in dear Jesus and, you know, not harming people and being loving, and they're ready to bomb and murder people, you know? A Christian nation, you know, it's so absolutely insane, you know, it's like a delusional system, you know, the churches are just completely false, even in the States, the churches now, all these ministers being paid off by the government to become agents of social control when the government does some another state-sponsored terrorist act to carry their agenda forward. And then they got all these preachers who are going to kind of go out and appease the sheeple, you know. It's a shame at seeing what became of religion.
Well, again, I would go back to what Gurdjieff says about, you know, that there are two aspects to religion. There's religious teachings, there's the what to do, and there's the how to do it. And that's what's been lost in modern Christianity and Judaism and Islam, is that for the most part, is that the farther that they get away from their esoteric origins, there's no instrumental teaching, so that people don't, as Gurdjieff said, you know, people call themselves Christians. Who here can really call themselves a Christian? Can you abide by Christ's precepts? Of course not, because you can't do. And if you can't do, you can't be a Christian. You have no right to call yourself a Christian. And I think that's, you know, that's a challenge that would really offend a lot of people who consider themselves to be Christians or Jews or Muslims or whatever, that you have to have an instrumental aspect to your teaching to live religiously. You have to be able to do. Otherwise, in Gurdjieff's terms, you're a machine to whom things happen, and they have to wake up to the reality of the fact that you're imprisoned by your psychological illusions, and the fact that you aren't conscious, that you exist normally in a state of waking sleep, and that it's only by awakening that you can acquire the unity and the will to be able to do things. And that's, you know, that's the real horror of the situation, is that everybody's always talking about, well, this person does this and this person does that, but nobody really does anything. You know, it all sort of happens, and it happens mechanically, and it happens with varying degrees of psychopathology. You know, and it's like what we talked about, you know, in previous weeks, is that, you know, is that horrifying story that, you know, that Uspensky told in 1916 when he sees the lorry loads of crutches going by, unpainted wooden crutches for legs which are not yet blown off. And he has this moment of kind of insight where he says, you know, I realized that seeing these crutches, it kind of just struck him in terms of the, it exposed the cynicism and that you know, in terms of all the fine words that were being said about people professing that they wanted peace and that the political solutions were going to arrive at this, when he said, you know, that these were crutches for legs that were not yet blown off, and they were legs that were not blown off in cities that he admired, and like, you know, all these different places, that like London and Paris and Prague and Rome and Constantinople, all these different cities that he had visited and he loved because they were so different. And now all of a sudden they were all his enemy because, you know, Russia was involved in this war. And you see the whole psychopathology of it all. And he reports this at the meeting of his group with Gurdjieff, and Gurdjieff says, what do you expect? You know, people are machines. And if 100 machines are unconscious, then 1,000 machines are unconscious. And 1,000 machines are unconscious, 1,000,000 are unconscious. And he said, you can't understand all the horror of what happens if you really understood that this all happens because millions of psychopaths are trying to kill millions of other psychopaths, you know, led by their psychopathic leaders. And unconscious people lead other unconscious people into unconscious acts. And it all happens. You know, that was 1916, the war to end all wars, the Great War, you know, the First World War. And then we had a Second World War, you know, and we had all these other wars in between, and all these wars subsequently, you know. And it's like, people profess to be interested in peace, you know, they say that they want peace, but we're always at war. Why?
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah, just all,
you know,
lies.
Nobody ever
all
questions,
lies.
You know, like that all the... all the political gobbledygook is just that. It's just a bunch of lies and fine words, you know, and that has absolutely nothing to do with reality. And all it is to prepare people to convince them to justify the fact that they're going to go out and kill somebody else, you know. That's really that's something that despite the barbarism of human beings and throughout history, it's something that people don't do willingly. And you know, you'd never know it from watching popular culture and war movies and you know, police dramas and stuff. But taking another human being's life is a very horrific event and a very traumatic event. You know, there's a great article in The New Yorker a couple of years ago about that, about even soldiers who go to war and believe in the rightness of their cause, they take another person's life, it affects them, you know.
Yeah.
They don't come home, they're not all happy about, you know, Greece and a bunch of terrorists, you know.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I wonder about how it affects, like, the psychopathic elites themselves, because in a way, they take tens of thousands and millions of people's lives, and in a way, it doesn't seem to affect them. Like, you don't see a change.
Well, exactly.
The elites, it's like they're most isolated from the wars. I mean, it's the young men and women, the soldiers and that, who are duped and betrayed, you know.
It's easier to kill people when you're not the one pulling the trigger. That's the whole point, you know. I think you're right. I think that's exactly true. I think that it doesn't bother them, you know. It's like that great line in the Godfather when, you know, Michael Corleone tells his fiance, you know, that, you know, and his father's is a mobster, and then he says, you know, he's just like any powerful person, like any senator or congressman, and his wife says, well, senators and congressmen don't have people killed, Michael, and this is right after the Second World War, and he looks at her and he says, oh, you know, who's being naive, you know?
Yeah.
You know, exactly. I mean, and that's the horror of it all, is that Yeah, I think that these people do. They do send millions to their death, and somehow they are able to sleep at night. You know,
I mean, imagine all those media people intentionally trying to kind of discredit the 9/11 truth movement and marginalize it and everything, and they know it's all a lie, and that's why I turn the TV on. It's like, it's horrendous seeing these people.
I don't know if they do know that it's all a lie. I mean, I think a lot of them just sort of dismiss it and don't really look at it. I mean, I think there's...
Even in that, I think there's knowing, because that's why they don't look at it, because they can't face it. They have to deny it because they can't. It's too much to really consider.
There's that. I mean, I think that's with a lot of people. Is I think people don't want to look at things and don't want
to. Yeah. I mean, it's hard to kind of wake up one day and realize that your government and country is run by, you know, a criminal mafia.
Yeah.
I mean, that's essentially what's happened. And, you know, the American dream became the American nightmare. America's being intentionally disbanded as a nation, and Canada, and all these things have been kind of carried on below our awareness. People have slept through the whole thing, you know. Turn on the TV and watch a football game and rah-rah and drink your beer, and, you know, human beings are so dummied down.
I was just thinking of... you know, I was reading some quote from Homer Simpson about baseball and beer, and it reminded me of something that when I first started watching The Simpsons, I said to a friend of mine, that is without a doubt the most realistic television program that there is, because it's not a cartoon, it's a documentary, you know. I mean, that's what's so funny about it, is that's exactly the way people are in my mind, you know. And, I mean, I put myself in that category on a variety of levels. I see myself in Homer Simpson, you know. And, I mean, that's the awful truth, in a sense, is that this is probably a much better representation of the mentality of people than all the so-called serious drama on television, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that's a kind of a disturbing thought, eh?
We should give those
numbers. Yeah.
Why don't you give those?
Oh, I don't have them. I thought you had them. I can get them in a sec.
Okay, and I'll look for them here, too.
I got them right here.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. In the U.S., it's 877-876-5227. In Canada, it's 888-815-9756. And the direct line is 530-876-3222.
Okay, so we'll see if we have any callers, and people are free to call in related to out-of-body experiences or experiences of consciousness apart from the body, or to relate to any of what Jim and I have been talking about.
Anybody knows a conscious politician, like to hear about that.
Or Ron Paul, that's still a phenomena. I mean, I don't think that's played out yet, and he's had such a huge impact.
But I mean, in a way, he hasn't, though. I mean, that's the whole thing. I mean, it's, you know, he's saying very interesting things, but his impact is zero, basically. His impact is on people who are willing to, you know, open their eyes and listen with real ears. But I'd say that, you know, I mean, he's marginalized. I mean, he doesn't get any votes. So it's like, you know, what impact does he have? It's all on Obama and Clinton and McCain, you know. Like
On the main media.
Fiddly-dee, fiddly-doo, fiddly-da. But, you know, Ron Paul's not going to get elected. So that's...
No.
I mean, but they... I see, if he could even be a voice, that would be one thing. It's like... It's just like when Nader was running, you know, against Gore and Bush Nader ran twice. I'm sort of blanking on Bush and Kerry. You know, when Nader ran, and they said, people say, well, Nader shouldn't run, and I'm thinking, well, telling me that Nader shouldn't run when Bush and Kerry are facing off is like telling me that that Einstein shouldn't get into physics because my dog and cat are already there. You know, it's like, come on. You know, like, I mean, Nader had something really important to say, and
yeah.
yet he was just kind of dismissed by the media, and there was all this kind of smirking about him, you know. And then he was like, oh, well, Nader cost John Kerry the election. Well, Nader didn't cost John Kerry the election. Jeb Bush gave, and the Supreme Court gave Bush the first election, you know. It's completely ridiculous. It's the other way around, actually.
Yeah.
It was Gorham's.
And it's also like you want this member of Skull and Bones.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, you know, it's like Louis Lapham, who used to be the editor of Harper's Magazine, wrote a whole book about that, about how the, you know, that in the United States there's this idea that, you know, that's a democracy and that any little boy can grow up to be president. Well, apparently now any little girl can too, but he said, you know, like that the whole point is that if you look who occupies the Senate and who runs for president, it's all basically the same people from the same strata, you know? Like, I mean,
yeah.
they're all part of the old boys network. They're all part of the same elite. And, you know, that not everybody can become president. That's the whole thing. It's like complete sham, you know? Pretty
yeah.
much the same in Canada, too.
Yeah, and both parties are controlled by the same corrupted system of corporate
yeah.
lobbyists and you know, underhanded groups like the shadow government. I mean, that I see the public figures are really only the pawns or puppets, and the forces behind it remain hidden from people. I mean, people are beginning to wake up to the kind of basis underlying the power politics underlying
yeah.
The American system. I think people are waking up to it, but it's quite horrendous. It's so tragic. I just see the amazing, you know, the Declaration of Independence and the idea of Canada and U.S. as free and sovereign nations. You know,
mm-hmm.
I think it is so ideal, and yet our sovereignties and nations have been undermined, you know, in this way by an elite group of people who don't represent anybody democratically or politically, and the whole thing is done subterraneanly,
yeah.
you know, below the surface. I mean, it's really treasonous, you know. I see it now. It's like these neo-Nazis have taken over our society, and that's what happened. The Nazis won. At least at the moment, they're still winning, the neo-Nazis. They did it. You know, everybody else is too asleep, you know, watching the football game and waving American flags made in China, you know.
Yeah, that's kind of ironic, yeah.
You know, meanwhile, you know, you're being poisoned by the fluoride and the chemtrails and the flu shots and inoculations, and all these devious things are being done. I believe they're making an effort to bring on worldwide food shortages. I think it's being done intentionally, because that's part of how they'll carry forward their agenda. You know? So I think we face pretty horrendous times, and unless we can get a grip on these things and turn our society around. But we'll have to see. I just hope we can get through to the presidential election and have a little bit more sanity somewhere before they end up extending the war into Iran. I mean, it's just terrible. You know, I think of those poor people in Iran, you know, like how unsuspecting they must be that here's this monster
on their doorstep. Oh, I don't think they're
unsuspecting.
Unsuspecting. I think that's one of the reasons, that's the irony, is that one of the reasons why they want a nuclear bomb is they don't want to be attacked by the United States, you know.
I mean,
that's never brought up in the conversation. I mean, you know, that's part of the problem, you know. The irony, too, is that realistically, by going to war in Iraq, well, what the United States has done is strengthened the Iranian-Iraqi ties by putting Shiites in power in Iraq. I mean, it's strategically, it's probably the worst possible thing they could have done, you know. But it ended up really backfiring on the big time, you know. And now it's just total chaos in Iraq, you know. Despite every time, you know, it's so much like Vietnam, you know. You just see the same patterns of lies being repeated, and the government just keeps pouring money into these places, but they don't raise taxes for it, which is bankrupting the American economy, too. That's the other
yeah.
side of it, you know. It's like, hey, you can't fight this war you can't spend this kind of money and not raise taxes, you know? I mean, how stupid are people, you know? They don't, there should be a, taxpayer's rebellion. You got to pay for this, you know, it's on some level. And
I mean, and that's happening in the States. I mean, people are beginning to realize the deviousness of the IRA and the banksters and people are, I think that is happening, that there's a seeds of tax revolution, that people don't want to finance their government's war industries, you know.
Yeah, well, I don't know about that. They don't want to pay, taxes, which is a different issue, but I'm not sure that that's the case. I mean, that, you know, John McCain will run on this platform. He'll say that, you know, we need, I'm a military veteran. I spent 5 years in a prisoner of war, you know, in the Hanoi Hilton. I mean, nobody ever kind of questions, you know, well, how did he get there? He was dropping bombs to the Vietnamese, you know, not exactly the most heroic activity, but... You know, he'll trade on that, and he'll say that, you know, you need a strong military leader because we're at war. And as I say, they just keep promoting this idea, like, we either have to be prepared for war or we have to be at war. And that legitimizes spending all this money, which could be much better spent. You know, you could improve the educational system. You could improve the healthcare system. You know, overnight, you can improve the roads. You can improve everything about American life if you'd cut your military spending in half. And you could cut your military spending in half and be just as secure as you are today. It's a complete and utter lie, you know, the whole thing. Just is, you know.
Yeah.
Like toys for the boys, you know, they spend billions of dollars on these things that really serve no purpose other than scaring the hell out of other people and making them want to get nuclear bombs so the United States doesn't attack them, you know.
Yeah.
It's kind of bizarre, but it's, you know, it's this self-perpetuating illusion that, you know, that if we don't do this, something bad's going to happen to us, you know. Like, and, well, and then, of course, 9/11 provided the excuse to, you know, now that there's no Cold War, we need some excuse to spend more money on the military. Oh, 9/11, how convenient. You know, the only problem is that they told people in their writings in the Project for a New American Century, we need a new Pearl Harbor, mobilize the people, you know. Brzezinski's book, you know, we need something like Pearl Harbor, or the populace won't go along with our aggressive military postures in Central Asia. You know, it's not
like these guys are trying to hide it.
It's right there, you know.
Yeah.
You know, it's like they tell you. They flat out tell you. And then if you say, well, you know, that 9/11 was an inside job, people will say, oh, you're a conspiracy theorist. No. You know, I've actually done some reading and I've looked at the evidence, you know. Like that's I've looked at people questioning it. It's like,
yeah, I mean, conspiracy theories supported by an overwhelming body of conspiracy facts.
Yeah.
You know, everything points to it. No, nothing. I mean, the government have their own conspiracy theory, which is that, you know, these crazy Arabs with box cutters did what they did. That's a theory. There's no evidence to support that.
Yeah, I've been reading David Ray Griffin's book on the 9/11 Commission, Omissions and Distortions, and, you know, one of the things that's really interesting is that if you go through the explanation of what actually happened on 9/11, you'll find that the military, essentially, there are three different versions of the timelines involved in terms of who was notified about what was happening and when by the Federal Aviation Agency, then to the military, and then what actions the military took. And if you look at it carefully, there are three different distinct versions, and the final version is the version that appears in the 9/11 Commission report. But one of the things that just is, I mean, there's so many things that are just so completely absurd and unbelievable, you know, but one of the things that really kills me is that that the plane was supposedly flying towards the Pentagon was that, that supposedly the military didn't know it was coming because the plane's transponder was turned off. You know, like when you turn the transponder off, that's when on civilian radar you lose it. You know, you don't know where it is.
Oh, yeah.
But the military has radar. You know, if somebody's going to attack your country, they're not going to turn the transponder on their bomber. If they're going to launch an intercontinental ballistic missile, they're not going to have a beacon on it so that you can track it, you morons, you know. And yet these guys try to pass this off as being real. I was like, well, the military didn't know where this plane is. So I'm like, give me a break, you know. A plane's headed for the Pentagon, you know, which has a sophisticated anti-missile defense system, you know. Oh, no, we didn't know what it was. Or, you know, the fact that the most sophisticated defense system in the world with the most number of planes and Air Force bases every 3 feet on the Atlantic seaboard couldn't get any jets up to look for the planes that were hijacked and prevent them from flying into buildings. I mean, the whole thing is so absurd when you look at it, you know, you look at the explanations. And what Griffin does, which is really good, is that, you know, and there are other people whose work he's drawn on. It's just not just him. But what's really good is that he just dissects all of these lies, you know. And I mean, and at the very least raises these very disturbing questions, you know. Like, I mean, at the very least his work is, if you approach it with an open mind, it will definitely make you, you know, rethink what happened on 9/11. I mean, he's the first person I read. And I read him because I respect his work as a theologian.
Yeah.
And I read his book, The New Pearl Harbor, and he just sort of set out, you know, different scenarios in terms of what kind of levels of complicity the government might have had and what happened that day, and just raised these very disturbing questions. And it was on that basis that I started to question the whole thing, because I realized, well, boy, this is, you know, for me, this is just like the Warren Commission, you know. It's like there's this official cover-up for this official story, which, when you start to look at it, makes absolutely no sense, you know.
Yeah.
It's like the old joke about, you know, people who are supposedly conspiracy theorists. You know, that one guy I read said, well, I'll accept people labeling me as a conspiracy theorist if they label themselves as coincident theorists, so, you know, because it would take a billion coincidences for their stories to hold up to any, you know, like the magic bullet theory in the Kennedy assassination.
Yeah.
The most unbelievable, stupidest thing ever proposed by anybody. You know, that guy sits in the American Senate, you know, Arlen Specter, that proposed it. I mean, it's a complete and utter bogus explanation of the Kennedy assassination. And yet, you know, 40 years later, if you say, well, Kennedy was killed by a conspiracy, which he clearly was,
yeah,
you know, people say, well, you're a conspiracy theorist, which is just a term to not engage you in a meaningful conversation about what may or may have not happened. You know, it means nothing. Conspiracy just means to breathe together. Two people breathing together are a conspiracy. You know, we're having a conspiracy right now.
And there's no there's no doubt these people meet in privacy, where they enjoy their kind of gatherings together, and they breathe together and do other things together and carry on their plans for what they want to do on the world stage. I mean, there's no, you know, to not be a conspiracy theorist, you have to be completely ignorant of everything happening in the media, in the world, and, you know, and you're a fool not to be, if you don't realize, you know, that it's a matter of historic record. And you see, just through history, the Oklahoma City bombings, the London bombings, the shooting at Columbine, all so many of these incidences, and then the follow-up investigations are always leave so many loopholes and unanswered questions, like the Kennedy assassination. Martin Luther King is another one. Listening on the radio lately, and there's evidence that James Earl Ray wasn't the shooter.
Oh, no.
I didn't even know. I'd never known there was that was another one. And
even
now it's come out Robert Kennedy wasn't shot by Sirhan Sirhan. There was other people there from the connected
CIA.
To one of the agencies that were involved in that again.
Well, even Malcolm X, you know, there's a large body of evidence to suggest that he was assassinated by, you know, people acting on behalf of the government. You know, I mean, it's interesting that the people who were the most public figures, who were most, you know, threats to the established order of things, all ended up being assassinated within a period of, 3 years. 6 years, I guess. 5 years, 63 to 68, you know.
And there's never any justice, eh? Like, these things just drag on and on. Okay, you know, the President of the United States is murdered, and there's a complete fraud commission, and, well, nothing can be done. Oh, dear, you know.
Well, that's how I say it. You know, I've been studying this for 30 years now, and I go in rounds. I get enthusiastic about reading because there's always more books. You know, there's like thousands of books about the Kennedy assassination, and when you read them, you know, and you start to relook at it. To me, like the thing that's really struck me more and more in recent times is I understand now. I've come to the conclusion that I see that I believe that what happened in the Kennedy assassination is that it, ironically is that really. I think what Oliver Stone puts forth in the movie JFK is basically what happened. It was a coup d'etat. I think it was carried out by elements of the military and the intelligence community, as well as using the organized crime. And I think that they did. Looking back and reading more and more, I realized that you know the military's anger with Kennedy over the Bay of Pigs. And with his supposed appeasement of the communists and the possibility that he was going to withdraw from Vietnam just doomed him, that's what happened to him, and that there were elements in the military. You know, there was a movie made called 7 Days in May, which was made, I think, in about 1962 by John Frankenheimer. Very good.
Oh, yeah, about the Cuban Missile Crisis?
No. Oh. It was about, it's with Burt Lancaster and Kirk Douglas, and it's about the military overthrowing the President of the United States.
Oh.
And it was based on a novel, and Kennedy had read the novel, and he contacted John Frankenheimer, who was making the movie, and said, "You can have any help you want in making this movie," because he feared that this was going to happen to him. Apparently, there are shots outside the White House. That is the White House. It's not a set. It, you know, he granted them permission, and he said that this was definitely a possibility. He felt that this would happen to him.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, and
well,
I think it did. I think it did happen to him. I mean, more.
I mean, it's not exactly the military. I mean, it's certain elements in the military controlled by the same elite.
Well, I don't even know about that. I mean, I think that those guys in the military were powerful enough and strong enough there's the other irony too, and also in the intelligence community, you know, these people were like a government unto themselves. But there's another thing is that when the Warren Commission is appointed. You know, who's sitting on the commission but Alan Dulles, who had been the head of the CIA until Kennedy fired him after the Bay of Pigs, and then he gets put on the commission to investigate his death. And
yeah.
I mean, what?
Like having Henry Kissinger investigate 9/11.
Yeah, exactly.
Or the fox and the hen house.
Like, wait a minute, you mean Sam Giancana, you know, the head of the mob in Chicago, wasn't available to take his place? I mean, it's just so absurd, you know. And then Gerald Ford, who became president, was a congressman at that point and was the inside man for the FBI and was leaking all sorts of information to J. Edgar Hoover, you know, and trying to steer it in different directions so that, you know, that the FBI wouldn't be, their complicity wouldn't be examined, you know. I mean, it's just like the whole thing is incredible. It's just
it's so shameful. You think of the amount of money Americans put into police, military, intelligence services, and then there's an assassination of Kennedy or the other Kennedy, all these major things, and never, ever does the truth come out about it.
Yeah, Martin Luther.
Never. This whole thing, the CIA, all these theme, all these, and never does the truth come out.
Yeah.
You know? Never. In fact, all these agencies are just complicit in hiding the truth from people. You know, it's just unbelievable. I wonder when people join the police and military. I thought people were supposed to make oaths to their country, you know.
A couple uphold the Constitution.
Yeah, of the United States
against
the enemies, domestic and foreign.
Foreign and domestic is like, yeah, well, they emphasize the foreign, but they should look at the domestic, you know. Like,
yeah, I think that's what people are realizing, that we were always led to believe that the enemy was foreign, whereas really the enemy was within our own society. In a way, we became our own worst enemy. Like, we want to fight terrorists, and now the United States is the world's leading terrorist organization, you know. They're a terrorist nation. They're a rogue nation.
Yeah.
They're invading countries. They're bombing people. You know, murdered 1.2 million people in Iraq. You know?
But they're only Iraqis.
Yeah, they're only Iraqis, you know.
But they don't count.
And we don't want to,
say, if you demonize people, it makes it easier to sleep at night knowing that they've died, you know, like, I mean. You know, I mean, another way of looking at it too is that you know, where's the outrage about the millions of people that die every year from every day, every month, every year from hunger? You know, entirely preventable, but
yeah.
You know, I mean, that's take your figure. You know, I did the math on the fifth anniversary of 9/11. I think I calculated it was something like 42 million people had starved to death in the 5 years since, you know, 9/11. Where's the outrage?
Wow.
About, yeah,
really?
Where's the outrage about that, you know?
Yeah.
Most of them children, and all of it entirely preventable, you know. There's no reason. I mean,
yeah.
There's absolutely no reason for people to be starving to death in this world where, you know, we have an abundance of food, and we could feed everybody on the earth if we really wanted to. Like, if
a fraction of all the money spent in the military-industrial complex.
You spend a lot of goodwill when you're feeding people too. You know, like, I mean, that's the thing. That's the thing that, you know, I mean, that's why the fallacy of all this is that you're always preparing for war, but you know, you can get a lot by trying to cooperate with people and trying to. You know, there's always going to be conflicts between people. I'm not naive enough to say that, but there's got to be a better way than just going and dropping a bomb on them every, you know, time you disagree with somebody. It just doesn't really work, and it doesn't bode well for the future. I read this thing about all the depleted uranium in Iraq, and saying that, you know, this was being blown all over the world and was poisoning people all over the world. You know, like
mm-hmm.
So. And it's, I mean, the first people who suffer from it are the ones that get hit with these shells. It kills them, but then it kills the people who live there. But it also kills the people who are firing them. You know, like the American soldiers. I mean, the levels of radiation exposure from these things is just wicked. You know, and that this is killing people. All these people have died or been, you know, seriously taken ill. From the first Gulf War, from exposure to depleted uranium, and now, you know, in Iraq and Afghanistan, firing these shells is just like, this stuff is incredibly, you know, horrific. It's just like, it's like Dr. Strangelove. It's just, you know, who could have imagined, who came up with this, you know? Like,
yeah.
Who's the madman? Who's the psychopath who developed that weapon? You know, like, I mean, that is just so out there. Oh, not only kills the other guy, kills the guy who fired it, you know? Well, that's great. You know, and kills anybody that the wind happens to be blowing. You know, it's like Dylan said. You know, it's a hard rain's going to fall. It's falling.
And you know, in Canada, as I understand it, the Canadian government has a law prohibiting the sale of depleted uranium for weapons.
Yeah.
And Canada's violating its own laws. I mean, these, you know, weapons manufacturers don't care. You know, they're just violating Canadian laws. You know, and again, the Canadian people don't say anything.
Yeah,
and there's protests now because they've opened up this new uranium mine in eastern Ontario, just west of me, which is just great, at Charbert Lake, north of Kingston.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the native elder was jailed for 6 months for protesting it.
Yeah.
You know? And so, open pit uranium. I mean, that's just great, you know, because it puts uranium particles into the dust clouds, you know,
which will blow your way and blow my way, and
my way more because
because the wind blows
west of
from
it.
The west, yeah.
It's just terrible. It's
very disturbing. It's amazing to me what people will do for a buck too. You know, that's the other thing is that it just all comes down to money when you really get down to it. So, well, power, sex, and money. You know, it's like the three lower chakras are dominating the world situation and dominate the way people lead their lives. Very disturbing.
Okay, well, I guess we haven't had a phone call. I haven't heard anyone pop in, but
yeah.
So we just got 20 minutes left. Yeah, I'm very worried about the world situation. I think it's very ominous signs. The collapse of the American economy is a huge, huge factor, and I think that could really gain momentum and really be a major. I mean, it's already major.
It's major, all right.
Yeah,
it's very, very serious. And
but I think when it comes to the the next steps, I think, are going to be food shortages and more unemployed and homeless people. And it's amazing when the American taxpayer then got, bamboozled into paying out the Bear Stearns rescue. And that's passed on to the American taxpayer to put out that huge amount of American tax money to shore up these banksters. It's just incredible the way the public's just robbed blind.
Yeah, it's funny, too, because they had a reputation, of being like the biggest hard asses on Wall Street for years and years, and not ever wanting to support any kind of rescue of any financial institution and God help us, and putting any money into anything that would help ordinary people. These guys were all about the big bucks that they made. I mean, they had record profits every year for, 50 years or something like that. But, it all boils down to the same thing, is people want something for nothing, and that's what the whole subprime mortgage thing was about, was that people were trying to make money by giving mortgages to people who really, shouldn't have been given them, and properties that, really couldn't support them, and everybody was trying to make a buck, by doing this, and make an easy buck by doing this, and then, the hard times hit, and all of a sudden, all these people are losing their homes, which is horrific, and, they're not going to get bailed out, but, financial institutions, that's a whole other story, but...
Yeah. No, the only way, I just think the only way to turn it around for America as a nation is if they enforce their own laws, and they... they charged people with mass murder when they commit mass murder, and they take the assets of all those people who supported this terrorist campaign against the American people. Take back the monies of all these people, and you'd pay off the American debt. Everything would be paid off, because all the American debt is probably owed to the same people who conspired to bring this about. You'd just pay off the American debt completely. I heard that fellow from Japan, what was his name, Benjamin Fulford, he said if you deconstructed the Rockefeller Foundation with all the monies that they have in all their charitable foundations, you'd have $100,000 for every man, woman, and child in America. So, that's probably what's owed per American, on the national debt, Mm. There's some fundamental... issues with the structuring of society that it's gotten to this drastic a level of criminality and criminal racketeering among our governments. I mean, it's quite horrendous. I could never have believed it.
Yeah, cheery times.
Yeah, I heard an interesting interview on the radio the other day, this Canadian farmer who fought Monsanto's. Because Monsanto's infected his wheat fields with their crops, they wanted to sue him.
Yeah, I know. This is the guy in Alberta. I think it's Alberta.
Don't really know.
I know the story. Yeah, oh, Monsanto.
And how they came after him and threatened him and intimidated him. There should be class lawsuits against Monsanto's for the terrible things they've done. It's just, this should be, it's just terrible with these Terminator seeds that they're introducing and polluting the native stock of different countries, and now the evidence is coming out that the GM foods are not good for people and creating cancers and ill health, and I guess they're banned in Europe now, genetically modified foods.
European
Union,
I think, has banned it. It's funny, there was a really, there was a book a few years back, about 5-6 years ago, called Into the Buzzsaw, which was a collection of pieces about suppressed news stories in the United States. And one of the best ones was about, it's been a long time since I read it, so I'll just describe it generically, but it was about this television journalist, I believe in Florida, who had done this story on Monsanto and who ended up losing her job and just being blackballed. And basically, what she was doing was exposing these their criminal activities, and they just came down on her like the wrath of God, and that's the problem, is that you don't see much There's quite a bit about in science magazines, for instance, about genetically modified foods and about, you know, the real concerns people have about this, you know, because, I mean, it's really tampering. It's like the Frankenstein story is tampering with nature in a way that you really don't want to be tampering and potentially catastrophic, you know. I mean,
yeah.
In terms of health risks and in terms of, you know, seed populations and just, you know, the dominance by agribusiness of individual farmers, you know, which is really quite sickening. But they're just so powerful, and they just have so much money, and they have so much power, and they have so much political power, and they have so much control over the media, you know, that they get away with this crap, you know. It's amazing.
Yeah.
I see now too that there's an article today by a guy who's a musician in the New York Times, and his band does a lot of their videos, puts them on the internet, and is talking about the movement toward trying to control the internet and create a tiered system in the internet, so that that the high speed bands and wide bands would be available to, you know, to people with money basically, and the rest of the peons like would be relegated to the lower levels. The internet was originally through phone lines mainly, and there's a clause in the communication system which called common carriage, I believe, that means that, you know, everybody basically gets the same phone service, in the sense that, you know, there's no sort of a stratification system in terms of its use. But now, with so much of the internet not being carried by phone lines, there's a movement towards stratifying the system and you know, marginalizing people and establishing corporate control over it. So,
I mean, they're moving ahead with their police fascist society state. I mean, they're
doing a pretty good job of it too, I gotta say. You know?
Sorry?
They're doing a pretty good job of it too.
Yeah, and it's so, like, what a waste of money and everything, eh? It's so incredible.
Human beings, what was it, psychopathocracy, you know? That's what it is.
Psychopathocracy.
Yeah, I like that.
The country run by psychopaths.
Yeah, very disturbing. Holy mackerel.
We never knew what hit us, you know. I think these patterns have gone on through history, but I think our time is unique a bit in terms of there being a broader awareness, people seeing the patterns and beginning to realize the deviousness. Because I think 9/11 was, to me, that was the most important event, because that, from 9/11, it unravels the whole sickness of the whole society.
Yeah, but I'm not sure that, you know, I mean, I don't know. I would say that, yeah, lots of people are aware that it's, you know, of the lies and the distortions and stuff, but so many people have been so galvanized and bought it completely, you know, and there's certainly a dissenting group, but they don't seem to have much power, you know, and it's interesting.
Yeah.
That
it was interesting the other day, yesterday, or 2 days ago, Alex Jones interviewed Governor Ventura from Minnesota. Who was the wrestler.
The wrestler, Jesse the Body.
Yeah, and he came out admitting 9/11 was an inside job. He had woken up to the fact.
Really?
And was talking about it. Yeah,
wow.
First, another major political figure. I mean, there are a number of them, but usually more of the people are retired.
He's not the governor of Minnesota anymore. No, he's not.
He said he was saying he wished he had realized more at the time. He just jumped on the same bandwagon.
Yeah.
I mean, most people, you know, when that horrible thing happened in New York, I mean, people were so traumatized that, you know, everybody did support a war. You think that you're being attacked like that. And, you know, you can see how you work up people up into a frenzy, you know, a hypnotic, delusional state, you know. You keep it going through the media.
Yeah.
And, I mean, they were introducing Osama bin Laden a half hour after the second supposed airplane attack on the second tower, and they started bringing his name in, like trying to feed it out there early on to kind of start creating the story. You know, the whole thing was all prepared ahead of time. They did a masterful job. I mean, it's amazing how
it's not
gullible
that
the public is that we
accepted.
Yeah, well,
it's not that masterful, because if you really look at it, you know, like, I mean, you know, it doesn't really hold up very well. And what stuns me is that the polls, stop that. Sorry, I got cats fighting here. The polls that appear in David Ray Griffin's book is that, you know, the majority of New Yorkers don't believe the story. Huge percentages in countries like in Europe is widely, you know, regarded as BS, you know. Like, I mean, I couldn't believe how many New Yorkers, according to these polls, don't believe it, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, wow, you know, how come this doesn't appear on the news at any point, you know? Like, where's the discussion in the august New York Times or the Washington Post or the L.A. Times or these great, you know, American media outlets? Why doesn't somebody discuss this, you know?
Yeah,
like, why?
Because they're all owned by the corporate media.
Well, yeah, but, I mean, geez, you know, like, there's got to be some sort of questioning about it. You know, why didn't somebody stand up and ask Hillary about this, you know? Or Barack Obama, you know?
A few of people do. On occasions, they try to, but these people get more and more isolated.
Yeah.
And then even when things like that happen, like, I've seen clips on YouTube of Clinton being confronted by 9/11 truthers and things like that, and it doesn't, the media would never cover it, you know, because they're complicit in covering it up, you know.
Yeah, it's amazing.
So these things can happen, but they just never aired for public consumption.
Well, then the spin after the spin is even worse, you know, is that, well, it was all, the war in Iraq was all failed intelligence, like, please. You know, like, I mean, that's such a complete and utter crock. It's unbelievable, you know. And that wasn't failed intelligence. It was exactly what they wanted, you know. They cherry-picked anything that, you know, that would confirm their idea that they had to go to war, and, you know, suppressed everything that said that they shouldn't go to war against Iraq. I mean, it's every level is a new level of spin to explain the former lie, you know. Like, it's incredible.
It's funny sometimes, you know, people kind of think, but, you know, you need protection for the people of Israel. Do people not realize that if there's a further war in Iran, how much that's going to pose threats to the people of Israel?
Yeah.
Like, it's like these people, it's not like it's the Israelis, like, it's not that. It's not the people of Israel. You know, they're completely deceived and dummied down like other people. You know, it's posing a huge risk for the Israelis who live in the area, too.
Yeah.
I mean, the United States, I mean, it's like they're willing to sacrifice their aircraft carriers, and I mean, all their military is at great risk if they start a war against Iran. I mean, Iran has, you know, major weapon systems, you know. They could easily, they may well take out the American, you know, a number of the American vessels.
Well, I'm not really sure how the United States can start another war, like, when they're already involved in two others at the present time, and they're not going very well. So, you know, like, that's why I kind of wonder. I just, you know, in a way, I don't see it. And I think Bush has got, like, he's got zero.
Yeah, I hope. I hope not.
I think he's pretty much done. I worry about McCain, though. You know, I worry a lot about him. You know?
Yeah.
I worry about Hillary too. Thank God she's not going to win. So, you know. If she's a liberal, you know, I'm the Pope. I mean, God, God help us if she's a liberal.
Anyway, okay, we have a few minutes left here. This has been Zero Point Radio. I'd encourage people to have a look at some of my writings on www.zeropoint.ca. Unfortunately, I haven't been in to revise my site for a while, but I do have a lot of writings up there. We'll be back in 2 weeks. And any final thoughts, Jim? Or?
Remember yourself always and everywhere. And, and next time, let's talk about, let's go back and talk some more about the heart doctrine let's talk about the heart doctrine. Let's talk about cosmic consciousness. That was one thing I wanted to come back to, but we can talk about that next time.
Yeah, great.
Yeah.
Okay, so thanks, BBS Radio. It's good we have these alternative internet radio shows where we can talk. talk about the issues that aren't addressed in the mainstream media. It's just really important, these independent efforts
to spread
the truth and part of the truth movement. And let's keep praying that we resist the onslaught of these elites and the New World Order agenda. Pretty horrendous thing. People kind of enveloped in this fascist mentality that's emerging. Let's get back to our true Christian and Muslim and Jewish values and the ideals of our nations. I encourage people in the military and intelligence communities, remember your oath of office. Why do you want to live in a slave state and enslave people? You know, let's try to remember the, you know, imagine peace, imagine a world of peace, and converting all the weapons monies into looking after, attending to humankind and solving the planet, the problems of the planet. It could have been done. We really never had a chance. Okay, so back in 2 weeks. Remember yourself. Let's stay upright of heart. Okay, this is Christopher Holmes. Thank you. Goodbye.
Yeah.